and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio or online at kpfa.org. My name is Sasha Lilly. It was a time of prolonged, brutal U.S. military aggression against a country on the other side of the world. And while there were mass demonstrations, they didn't stop the war, and the bombings continued apace. While it sounds familiar, I'm speaking not of today, but of the 1960s. Then, as now, American activists grappled with intense feelings of despair and powerlessness to halt the violence unleashed in their name. In the 1960s, some decided to take up arms, including a controversial group of white, middle-class young people who had been members of Students for a Democratic Society. They adopted the name Weatherman, later changed to the Weather Underground, and, depending who you ask, they represent the promise of the 1960s new left gone terribly awry, or provide a model for anti-racist and anti-imperialist resistance. Nearly 30 years after their disbanding, what can we learn from the ideas and experience of the Weather Underground? Were they a bunch of adventuristic provocateurs, radicals committed to ending white supremacy, or perhaps a combination of the two? Dan Berger tries to answer those questions in a new book. It's titled Outlaws of America, The Weather Underground, and the Politics of Solidarity, and it's published by AK Press. He's an activist and co-editor of the book Letters from Young Activists, Today's Rebels Speak Out. He joins me from Philadelphia. Welcome, Dan, to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So you argue that we can't understand Weatherman without understanding the political and social circumstances of the late 1960s in which it came into being. So I wonder if you can give us an overview of that context, both within the U.S. and internationally.
Definitely. I mean, you touched on some of it in your introduction in terms of talking about this massive and unending war in Vietnam. But I think the other big piece of it is really, you know, Vietnam as a centerpiece of global struggle against colonialism. So you had a lot of former colonies throughout the Third World who were, you know, united in these national liberation movements to kick out their former colonial rulers, and also many of them established some form of socialist government. At least that was their goal. And they were doing so together. There was a lot of support and fraternity among the various Third World movements, and I think that was replicated within the U.S., particularly within the Black liberation struggle. And, you know, it's great to be talking about this today on the 35th anniversary of George Jackson, who was one of many important figures in that struggle in the 60s and 70s,
right,
who, you know, as I'm sure most listeners know, was a field marshal of the Black Panther Party, murdered in prison in San Quentin. And I think the, you know, the Black struggle and other struggle by communities of color in the U.S. also did a lot to build a radical program, and one around which many radicals unified, that placed the political struggle in a really global context. So it wasn't just the despair of unending repression, but also this tremendous sense of hope and possibility that another world could be created.
Right. Well, one of the movements, many movements active during the 60s was Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, which had its first convention in 1962. I wonder if you could talk about its trajectory throughout the 1960s. And I should just add that SDS has recently been refounded as an organization and has been opposing the Iraq War on college campuses.
Definitely. SDS formed in the early 60s and, you know, sponsored the first demonstration against the war in Vietnam in April of 1965 and continued to be a major force both in anti-war activism but also in terms of solidarity with various anti-racist struggles, again, particularly with civil rights movement and then later Black Power and other such efforts. And, you know, as the 60s grew, particularly, you know, 1968, I think, was this tremendous turning point with the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, with the murder of Martin Luther King, with these pitched battles in Mexico and Czechoslovakia and so many other places around the world. I think SDS became more more intense, more fractured, people really feeling an urgent need to find a revolutionary direction to respond to the demands of the period. And I think that resulted in a lot of different choices that people made.
Well, one of the choices that people made happened in 1969. really at the end of SDS's existence as an organization, when the organization fractured into a number of different factions, and the Weather Underground, what was to later become the Weather Underground, came out of those splits. Tell us about that time. What was going on there? What issues were at stake?
Definitely. SDS, you know, as an organization, really became famous for its anti-imperialist program, this way of combining opposition to war abroad and racism at home. And there was a group called Progressive Labor, which was a small kind of sectarian Maoist organization that had attempted to exert its control over SDS, declaring that all nationalism was reactionary, which meant withdrawing support from the revolutionary nationalist struggles in Vietnam, of the Black Panther Party, and others. So there was a bitter kind of factional dispute over really what the program and what the future of SDS was going to be like. I mean, as an organization that was trying to ally itself with all of these revolutionary movements, many folks, not just those that would go on to become the Weather Underground, were arguing that they couldn't allow a group that was more conservative than its program to really remain in the organization when they were targeting those same policies at a national level. So, you know, that was really, I think, at the heart of the debate that led to the split. But other issues were also included, particularly women's liberation, and a lot of folks really feeling frustrated by the male left to respond to their needs. So I think several things were going on, but really the centerpiece was how was this organization of predominantly white radicals going to respond to the third world movements inside the U.S. and outside the U.S.
Tell us about the faction that eventually became Weatherman. Who was in that organization or in that faction? What was the program that they were advocating within SDS?
Yeah, Weatherman came on the scene first as a position paper that was printed in a conference issue of SDS that appeared before the final, what turned out to be the final SDS convention in June of 1969, and really argued for a strong sense of militancy and the involvement of white people in struggles against war and against racism, which, you know, as a general kind of politic, certainly characterized much of SDS at this time period, although I think Weather kind of took it a step further in really saying that solidarity was the centerpiece of the politic, and what solidarity meant in 1969 was the, you know, the urgent need for white people to respond in dramatic and audacious ways, not simply through violence, although that was something that the group decided to use in terms of targeting empty government or corporate buildings with bombs between 1970 and 1976, but also just with a sense of creativity and audacity and urgency. This was a time that was seeing, you know, dozens of Black Panther leaders murdered, hundreds of Black activists arrested, put in jail, and the fact that there was not a significant outcry among much of the white left, I think, really spurred Weather's urgency and commitment.
Well, in October of 1969, the leadership of Weatherman called for thousands of young people to convene in Chicago, what has been called the Days of Rage. What was the logic behind this action, and what happened there?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, Weather comprised some of the most experienced, committed organizers in SDS, and yet when they constituted themselves as Weather, some of their leadership skills and know-how kind of went out the window. The Days of Rage was a militant protest that was organized as an intentional street fight with the Chicago Police Department, precisely because that police department was so notoriously brutal in repressing demonstrators at the Democratic National Convention the previous summer, and really, you know, the Black movement and others. So the Days of Rage was a chance to really, you know, as the slogan put it, bring the war home. That, you know, the United States and Chicago in particular, and at that time it was trying 8 prominent radicals for their role in the 1968 Democratic National Convention protests, that Chicago and that America could not be allowed to persecute war at home and abroad and sleep comfortably at night. So this was a chance to really make people confront the realities and the consequences of American imperialism. However, in practice, it consisted not of the tens of thousands of people they expected, but of a few hundred people running through some of Chicago's ritzy neighborhoods, smashing store windows and car windows and anything else in their way.
And how did this, the consequences, the fallout from the days of rage, affect the decision of the leadership of Weathermen to go underground and essentially say goodbye to the SDS as a mass above ground organization?
Right. Well, you know, a lot of the Days of Rage organizing consisted of telling people that this was the major action and the way that people could show their solidarity and support, even though it proved quite controversial. And so, you know, the fact that so few people did show up really, rather than spurring a kind of needed rethinking, which the group did embark on a few months later, immediately following the Days of Rage, it fueled their arrogance that they were the only white people who got it, the only ones really willing to do what it took to be revolutionaries in this country. And so I think, in a certain sense, it furthered their urgency and furthered their bravado in the path that they were trying to create. Although at this point, they were still trying to be both above-ground and underground activists. But with the more militant demonstrations, the more people got arrested, the more they were facing lengthier charges. Although I think it's worth noting the overall tenor of militancy at the time, 1 month after Days of Rage in a protest in Washington, D.C., an anti-war protest in Washington, D.C., there was a breakaway march of 10,000 people that trashed the Justice Department and was very militant and was really the vision of Days of Rage come home. And Weather was a part of that, but really just one part of it. So I think in a certain sense, the idea of militancy, the idea of confrontation with the state in that way was shared by many radicals. What people objected to was the sense of arrogance that characterized much of Weather's organizing at that point.
Also, don't you think that the leadership really squandered an enormous opportunity by going underground instead of focusing on building a militant but mass-based organization through SDS, given that they really had control of this organization, which numbered, 100,000 people?
Yeah, at its height, estimates are that SDS had about 100,000 people. And I think, you know, the ability to have a militant above-ground mass organization certainly would have been of tremendous importance. And I think Weather, you know, played a role in preventing that from happening. But again, just a role. I mean, this is a broader context in which many forces were at work. And I think its arrogance turned a lot of people off. But there were also other folks who were, you know, abandoning SDS to try and build, you know, smaller cadre-based organizations or communist parties, people who were leaving the sense of any kind of mixed gender left to build and maintain women's liberation movement, who are going to kind of back to the land communes. So I think there were a lot of forces that were pulling at SDS and preventing that furtherance of that mass movement that it had been building towards to date.
And that's the voice of Dan Berger. He's the author of Outlaws of America, The Weather Underground and the Politics of Solidarity, published by AK Press. Well, before we go further into the history of Weatherman, the Weather Underground, I want to talk about a Weatherman participant who really sort of serves as a moral guide in your book, Outlaws of America, and that is David Gilbert. I wonder if you could tell us who he is and why you find him so compelling.
David Gilbert is a former member of SDS and the Weather Underground, who is currently a political prisoner serving a life sentence in New York for his role as a white ally to a Black Liberation Army action in 1981, in October of 1981, in an action gone terribly wrong, in which bank robbery gone terribly wrong, in which two police officers and a Brink security guard were killed. But before that, you know, he had an expansive and impressive activist career, and since then has had an impressive and expansive career in prison, particularly around AIDS education and organizing. And I started writing with David when I was about 16 years old, found a book of biographies of political prisoners in the U.S., and started writing with several of them to try and learn a sense of movement history and lessons and, you know, things to possibly do for today. And just something about David's biography and the humbleness and the humility with which he wrote really reminded me of kind of like an uncle I never had. He just seemed the most like me in terms of a white Jewish man from the middle-class background in the Northeast, really trying to grapple with these difficult questions of racism and of imperialism. So began a correspondence with him that ultimately worked its way into this book. And, you know, his arrest in 1981 with this tragic action really captured a lot of attention and was said to be the final, you know, end of the 60s or proof that any sense of, you know, white solidarity with black movement is insane. And yet, you know, the story seems so much deeper to me. So I thought using his story as kind of a narrative guide to tell the larger story would be a way to really understand the history and the lessons, both positive and negative.
Well, I'd like to play an edited excerpt of an interview with David Gilbert. He was interviewed in 1998 by the filmmakers Sam Green and Bill Siegel, who made the Academy Award-winning documentary The Weather Underground. There's a fair amount of background noise in this piece because he was interviewed in federal prison. And now, former weatherman, political prisoner David Gilbert.
I got involved with Weatherman and then what became the Weather Underground back when it formed in 69 and 70. And we formed in the cauldron of intense struggle against the war in Vietnam and racism at a time when the Black Panthers, who were leading force in the black struggle that we identified with, were getting cut down and assassinated, at a time when we were highly charged and moved by pictures of children of Vietnam getting napalm, massive demonstrations that didn't stop the war. In that context, we came out of the radical student movement, at that time predominantly white, called Students for a Democratic Society. In the context of seeing a lot of the people who inspired us and who had led the protests getting assassinated or put in prison, and a war that was so brutal and wouldn't stop, a small section of what was the broad student movement decided we had to be in a position to carry out illegal forms of struggle against the government. What happened when I was still in high school, my best friend in high school had an exchange student from Vietnam living with him. She wasn't a communist, she was from an aristocratic family. But she let us know that in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh was considered the George Washington of Vietnam, that they were the ones who fought for independence. And the so-called regime in government in South Vietnam had been imposed by the United States as a continuation of French colonialism. The civil rights movement opened up that America was not a practicing democracy. Malcolm X raised the issue of self-determination and human rights. Black power in 66 taught us that it is a nature of a power structure, and we had to deal with opposition to that power structure. And then, of course, the Panthers and other revolutionary nationalist groups of the period, in getting past 66 into 68, 69, really brought home the identification with national liberation struggle and the right for people to fight against their oppressive and racist regime for total independence. We made a lot of very bad mistakes in this period of time. And in retrospect, I feel it was precisely because most of us had such little experience with violence and so little relationship to violence, and it led really relatively sheltered lives. And as I said, for my first 7 years of activism, I was philosophically a pacifist. That to me, there was an aspect of what we did that was psyching ourselves up to make the jump over this hurdle from sort of a more comfortable middle-class life to building an underground and taking an unarmed struggle. There was some romanticization of violence, some statements made that really are disgusting. So I'd say it was this level of energy, excitement, pushing forward to take this tremendous leap, and a lot of psyching ourselves up that had some negative consequences. The other tenor was, of course, the majority of people on the left attacked us tremendously, because the idea that being a revolutionary meant actually fighting the government on that level was pretty upsetting. But there's that sense of attack and being in battle, but we in turn were extremely sectarian. Sectarian's a word within the movement by which we mean, you know, if you're not doing things exactly like we are, you're not any good. And we were extremely arrogant towards other people. We're the only true revolutionaries. We're the only ones who are responding to the racism of the society and willing to fight. And we really turned off and alienated a lot of people who were decent people and potential allies. And not only is that a wrong way to deal with people, it really weakened achieving our own goals, which is to build a stronger movement as we could against the war and against racism.
And that was weatherman David Gilbert, interviewed in 1998 in federal prison where he's serving a life sentence without parole. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by phone from Philadelphia by Dan Berger. He's an author, activist, and scholar of the weather underground. Later in the program, we'll get into the critique of the flaws of the weather underground. But I wonder, Dan, if you can talk about the movement's, the organization's stance on racism and white privilege, which seem to, from the book, believe provides a model of sorts that we should learn from.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with anything, there's shortcomings and there's positive aspects, even in the positive aspects, there's shortcomings. But I think that their analysis of white privilege and white supremacy still offers a valuable lesson, perhaps, you know, one of the most valuable lessons of the group for radicals and white folks in general today. And really, you know, it built heavily off of the radical revolutionary black nationalism and black power movements as espoused by the Panthers and folks like Malcolm X and others, but really seeing it as, you know, a manifestation of U.S. empire at home. That white supremacy dictated U.S. foreign policy as well as the relationships domestically. And this was the, you know, analysis shared by many of, you know, internal colonialism, that U.S. wasn't just oppressing nations overseas, but also, you know, communities as within the U.S., so black people as a kind of internal colony of the U.S., or Native Americans as an internal colony of the U.S., And with that, with such an analysis, white people had both a responsibility, but also a tremendous opportunity to respond in solidarity with these struggles. So I think, you know, really the strength of the group is here were a bunch of white folks, many of whom from the middle class, although some wealthy, some from working class backgrounds, really seeing opposition to white supremacy and solidarity with these movements of people of color has the centerpiece to progressive change in this country. And that solidarity meant, you know, being able to have your own kind of analysis, agenda, platform, and program responding to the overall or the overarching context set by those communities and those struggles.
But do you believe that the choices available to white activists at the time were simply between either becoming a white anti-racist fighting force like the Weather Underground or being complicit in a racist system? I mean, there were other militant groups, the New Communist Movement included, took a different road of militant organizing around both race and class, but they did so under either a multiracial leadership or leadership by people of color.
I don't think the necessary outgrowth of their analysis was to have an underground organization. I think that that's something that they embraced at the time and embraced, you know, a bit too willingly or a bit too uncritically. But I think, you know, even then there was a recognition that this was part of a broader movement and that, you know, its underground actions weren't the only thing that defined it as an organization or defined its politics. But certainly the notion of solidarity was not something that was only expressed through such underground actions. And I think groups in the New Communist Movement and in other sectors of the anti-imperialist movement offer a lot of lessons. I mean, you had other underground groups like the George Jackson Brigade, similar clandestine groups in the Catholic left, from some women's communities and lesbian communities. So I think they were, you know, a part of this, you know, having a conversation with a broader movement. And really central to that was that these, you know, national liberation struggles, particularly the black struggle in the U.S., really were setting the context of global struggle at the time.
But I guess I'm sort of getting at the idea that that white people should organize just as white people and organizing other white people, and yet there were other militant organizations that were multiracial.
Absolutely. I think that's true. And they were, you know, again, part of a wing of a movement. They were dialoguing with other folks. They were, you know, I mean, not representative of all that was going on. Absolutely.
What was the relationship between the Weather Underground and radical nationalist movements like the Black Panthers?
It varied, and, you know, particularly by the time Weather came on the scene, the Panthers were beginning to fracture, both due to internal differences, but also, of course, due to the intense government efforts to repress and wipe out the Panthers. So relationships were mixed. You know, famously, you can see it in the documentary, Fred Hampton really opposed the Days of Rage demonstration.
And Fred Hampton was the leader of the Black Panthers in Chicago.
Yes, exactly.
Who was assassinated by the FBI or the U.S. Government.
Right. In his sleep in December of 1969 at age 21, along with fellow Chicago Panther Mark Clark. So Fred Hampton opposed the Days of Rage as kind of a suicidal effort, and at the time when the Panthers were trying to build mass support as an organization facing extreme attack, viewing this as, you know, more than excessive and unnecessary. At the same time, Fred Hampton and others in the Chicago chapter maintained a relationship with Weather, and had, you know, had a critical view towards them, but they were still in dialogue. They still had a sense of relationship and study groups and working together. Other Panthers similarly opposed Weather, but then there was also a wing of the Panthers that saw Weather and its allies as the best thing the white left had to offer. Perhaps most famously, this was expressed by the Panther 21, who were members of New York chapter of the Black Panther Party, who were on trial for a slew of bogus conspiracy charges, and wrote a very constructive criticism of the organization in early 1971, in response to a communique that the group had released, and the Panther 21 were really urging them to, you know, stick to the principles that they had put forth originally in terms of being this white anti-racist fighting force. And said, quote, that the degree of racial coexistence greatly depends on your success. So I think that, you know, and some of those folks would later go on to form the Black Liberation Army. So I think they and other such groups really look to Weather as the kind of corollary. And, you know, the Panther 21 is a classic example of, you know, a huge mistake that Weather made in terms of never responding to the criticism that that the Panthers raised. But there were forces in these various revolutionary nationalist communities who really saw Weather as the most natural ally and corollary in the struggle.
Well, in its early days, Weatherman was openly scornful of other movements and burned many bridges with its sectarianism, something that David Gilbert refers to in the clip we played. Once underground, how did the organization view the importance of mass organizing above ground?
Yeah, it received a painful lesson when a bomb some members were making in New York City in March of 6th of 1970 exploded, accidentally killing three people. And this forced the group to really take a step back and evaluate the past 9 months, or the first 9 months of its existence, in which it had burned those bridges and been so arrogant and exuberant in the expression of its politics. And, you know, after that, one of the main errors I think the group recognized was the way that it had turned so many folks, including many natural allies and former friends and comrades, away. And so they were, you know, embarked on a slow process of trying to at least rebuild, you know, apologize, rebuild relationships where possible. And sometimes those turned into long-lasting, you know, friendships or support, and other times it too much, the damage was already done. But embarking on this process and trying to be more in dialogue with the above-ground movement and really, you know, beginning to see itself much more as one expression of this mass movement rather than as the sole entity in it.
Well, in that townhouse explosion that you mentioned, and that happened in 1970 in Greenwich Village, where as you say, three members of the Weather Underground accidentally exploded a bomb, killing three of them and wounding two others. That was also pivotal because the bombs that they were making were actually being made to kill civilians. Talk about that and the evolution of the organization's thinking about taking the lives of non-combatants.
Yeah, that bomb was to be used at a non-commissioned officer's dance in Fort Dix, New Jersey. And it would have been the first time that an action or that a bombing would have targeted people intentionally. There was one previous effort that didn't go off that was actually built by the only FBI infiltrator of the group, Larry Grathwall. But this was, you know, in a period of tremendous intensity and excitement about this path. And in the clip, David talks about psyching ourselves up for violence. You know, this group of predominantly middle-class folks trying to really, you know, make this huge leap away from everything that they had been kind of brought up with. You know, the ways in which their kind of early arrogance separated them from so many other folks that, you know, thought that white folks in the U.S. were too corrupted by privileges of empire to really side with the Vietnamese or side with the Panthers, believing that it was time to, you know, raise the struggle even more. The logic being, you know, that if it's okay for, you know, Vietnamese fighters to shoot down soldiers dropping bombs over them, was it not okay to shoot down those soldiers before they got in those planes? But being a dance, it wasn't just soldiers about to go to war, it was, you know, their dates, their partners, and many others that would have been affected. So I think it was the ways in which it was, you know, unmooring itself from its humanist groundings, although it had been at least grounded enough to not have hurt people in any action before then, and after this mistake, immediately rethinking its actions and rethinking its role in the movement.